From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, how Governor Snyder hopes to use part of the state's $971 million windfall.
So as the governor said in the state of the state, he's looking to target hardworking folk.
What NAFTA looks like from the Mexican side of the border.
Free trade agreements are going to have winners and losers, and very unfortunately for the U.S., a lot of the losers have been concentrated in the U.S. auto industry.
As colleges send students to work and study in Detroit, who gets the most from those relationships?
The things that happen when people come to a city, live in the city, benefit from the city, and then relatively soon leave the city behind, that's an American story.
And we learn how Native American principles are powering a special court in Washtenaw County. Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for joining us today. Universities across Michigan send their students to work and study in Detroit. Advocates say it's a good place to test out new ideas and create community involvement. But some have worries that it can be demeaning to the city and its people, treating them like one big laboratory. On today's show, the relationship between college students and Detroit. Who gets the most from these relationships? And then we'll try to answer the question, a question you've probably asked aloud. Is this indeed the snowiest winter ever in Michigan? That's later this hour. But first, ever since it became clear that Michigan has an almost $1 billion revenue windfall, the questions are centering on how best to use that money. Republicans are talking tax relief as Democrats blast past tax increases. In presenting his new budget for fiscal year 2015, we got an idea now of what Governor Snyder is proposing. If he gets his way, about 1.3 million of us could see a rebate check averaging $75. We find out more now as we say hello to MLive's Capitol reporter, Jonathan Osting. Hey, Jonathan.
Hey, Cindy. How are you?
Good. So what is the governor's proposal exactly?
Well, as you mentioned, it would affect about 1.3 million people, and it would do so by revising the homestead property tax credit, which is available to people actually when they file their income taxes, but it's based on property taxes or rent that they paid out in taxes earlier in the year. So this would essentially revise the formula for people who already qualify for the tax credit, and then it would extend sort of an income cap on who can qualify. So more people would qualify, and those who already do would get a little more money back.
And if this all happens, when might they actually see rebate checks?
They're talking this summer. The Treasury Department says it actually would be pretty easy to do. They'd recommend that people file their taxes as they normally would, and then Treasury would hit some sort of a magical button, recompute everything, and send out checks based on the new computation.
And I know the governor, when he sat down with you guys, said, hey, it's a great outcome, and it's nice and simple.
It is fairly simple in that it would apply to a small amount of people. The actual calculation for the homestead property tax credit is a little bit complicated. So he's trying to propose reducing the income multiplier, which would in effect increase the tax rebate. So it's a little hard to explain in layman's terms, but the effect would be fairly simple anyway. Taxpayers wouldn't really have to do anything. Like I said, Treasury hits the button, sends out checks.
So why do you think he is pushing this both politically and economically?
Sure. Well, I mean, politically, there's a lot of arguments about whether this is just making up for previous cuts, as you mentioned in your opening. Democrats have been pushing to increase the homestead tax credit for a couple years, ever since the Republican-led legislature reduced it back in 2011. So this is the very same tax credit that's already been reduced by the same governor, the same legislature. And there were also several other changes made in 2011. The earned income tax credit was reduced. Senior pensions were taxed under the current personal income tax. So a lot of changes were made in the past. The state's now seeing a lot more revenue. The idea is, they have some money to give part of it back. The governor likes this proposal because it specifically targets people who make under $60,000 a year. A third of them, according to the budget department calculations, would be seniors. So a lot of those seniors frustrated by the so-called pension tax would perhaps benefit from this rebate specifically. There's other talk about an income tax rollback, But that would be across the board and would impact, you know, somebody who makes $120,000 a year just as easily as it would be somebody who makes $50,000. So as the governor said in the State of the State, he's looking to target hardworking folk.
Well, we know there are some Republicans who are very loudly calling for that across-the-board tax cut. So what kind of response is the governor's proposal getting from Republicans and from Democrats?
As I mentioned, Democrats are saying, fine, great, but this still doesn't undo the damage from 2011. Republicans, on the other hand, there's a wide variety. I mean, certainly there are backers of the income tax rollback. On the other end of the spectrum, chair of the House and Senate Appropriations Committees both would prefer a one-time rebate check as opposed to the governor's, which would, in fact, be ongoing. So the governor's plan would be about tax relief this year, but it would also apply to tax year 2014 and so on and on and on. So there's a lot of variety, it's a debate that Republicans are seemingly eager to have after having debated raising taxes last year when talking about roads.
So, best bet, is the governor's plan going to get through the legislature?
I doubt it'll get through exactly as he proposed. I think that it certainly will be one of the options that they consider. State Senator Dave Hildenbrand has already introduced legislation that's sort of similar to the governor's plan. His is a little more generous, however. It would raise the income threshold from 50 to, I think, about 70,000, whereas the governor wants to do 60. They'll debate those numbers. I mean, some form of tax relief is all but inevitable. It may not be exactly what the governor is proposing, though.
And do you think if this was not a big election year, do you think we'd be having this conversation?
Well, that's a really good argument. A really good question. It certainly seems politically advantageous. The governor maintains that he doesn't make decisions based on politics. He's a numbers guy, and the numbers are working in his favor right now. Granted, that is because of some changes that the Republican-led legislature made in 2011.
Jonathan Osting of MLive, thanks so much. Always good to talk with you.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Cindy.
New research out of Michigan State University finds it's not voters who should get the blame for lack of minorities in state legislatures, but rather it has to do with political parties. Eric Gonzalez-Inkey is an assistant professor of political science at MSU. Eric, you looked at almost 10,000 state elections. What did you find?
The surprising finding was that in districts that were heavily made up of white voters, we did not find any, or I did not find any bias against Latino candidates for office. And so one of the reasons this is surprising is that for decades we've understood the biggest barrier to minority or underrepresentation in legislatures, and particularly for Latinos and African Americans, to be white voters in white districts.
So you found Latino candidates, for example, were on the ballot just about 5% of the time, but when they were on the ballot, then they won just as often as their counterparts, even in those districts where most of the voters were white.
That's right.
So it sounds like your research has found that underrepresentation of minorities in state legislatures has a whole lot more to do with political parties than the actual voters who are trucking in there and casting votes.
That's the implication, and that's where we're headed next. So we need to figure out what's going on in the recruitment process, how parties support minority candidates, what kind of candidates are being recruited, and then research that actually looks at the pool of candidates themselves. Why aren't more minority candidates deciding to emerge or deciding to run for office? What are they doing instead? And what's nice is this dovetails with a more advanced literature on women and women candidacies. And what they found in that literature is almost exactly what we're finding here for Latinos and African Americans, and that is that when women run, generally speaking, they do quite well, but there seems to be a problem getting them into these candidacies.
Getting them on the ballot in the first place.
That's right. That's right.
We've actually had that discussion on stateside with women, including former lawmaker Barb Byram, who exactly said that. It's getting on that ballot. And so it sounds like the voters are prepared to send the best person, irrespective of the last name or the gender.
Yes, voters care about party. And this is something that we understand in political science very clearly. Voters care about party, and who the party will represent, not who is representing the party. And so if you run somebody under the party banner in these, particularly in these very polarized times that we're in, they're going to do well. Voters will override whatever biases they may have for the most part.
Eric, do you think your research has the potential to actually change things and the way that candidates are chosen?
I hope so. I hope so. You know, one of the explanations could just simply, you know, I hope it's this simple, that party elites simply thought that minority candidates couldn't win in white districts. We haven't been able to look at this previously because we didn't have the data to do it. And so that data is emerging over the last 5 or so years. And hopefully it's as simple as that, right? I come along and some of us say, you know, go ahead, it's okay. Don't fear white voters and white voter bias, and, you know, they'll kind of change. That would be great.
Do you see a time when political parties will embrace more diverse candidates?
I think it's happening. It's happening at a very small scale. I hope that it starts to happen more. You see this on both the Republican and Democratic side. Again, to the extent that we need to see this much more at the local level, at the state level, I think that's what needs to happen. At the federal level, we're start to see a lot of minority candidates and minority elites being at least put in the front by both parties.
Eric Gonzalez-Inkey is an assistant professor of political science at Michigan State University. Thank you so much, Eric.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. If you ask just about anyone in Michigan about the winter weather, chances are he or she will swear there's never been this much snow. Well, yes and no. Some cities shattered their snowfall records in January, but in some parts of the state, the January snowfall was pretty much business as usual. So let's see who has legit bragging rights when it comes to snowfall, as we're joined by MLive meteorologist Mark Torregrossa, who also runs the site farmerweather.com. So, Mark, where are we seeing that extra heavy snowfall?
There are two spots in the state that kind of have abnormally high snowfall. One spot is from Jackson through Ann Arbor to Detroit, and that's mostly because there were two snowstorms there that hit that part and didn't hit other parts of the state. That real big 17-incher, and then a little bit after that, there was another 10-inch snow there.
Yeah, that was real fun, by the way. I'll just point out, speaking from living in that corner of Michigan, real fun.
Yeah, real, real fun. And then the second area is lake effect snow up by the Traverse City area up through Gaylord. Because we had the cold air so early and the lakes had not cooled off, that area actually well above normal in snowfall. Some places like Maple City, which is smack dab in the middle of Willamette County, over 200 inches already so far.
Wow. Now, we heard a lot from Detroit reports about Detroit breaking its records for January snowfall, 39.1 inches, I believe, up from 29.6, the old record set back in 1978. What other cities broke their records for January snowfall?
January was the southern part of the state. It was Ann Arbor and Detroit. Flint also for January snowfall set records. And it's starting to pile up. Detroit so far has had their fifth snowiest winter ever. And if I remember correctly, they would need 20-something more inches to break the old record and have the snowiest winter ever.
Well, which leads to the thing that everybody's asking, you know, as we all talk about the weather, what might we get through February and March? And I know it's far out to look, but what are your thoughts as far as the kind of snow we might see before winter calls it quits?
Well, I think we're going to back off on the cold temperatures, but we're going to do that because we're going into a southwesterly flow over the next few weeks. And I don't see anything real big imminent on the near horizon, but with that kind of flow, we could still have several snowstorms, and they could still be big snowstorms. So I got a feeling we still have at least 10 inches of snow to go, and probably 15 to 20.
But we can kiss the polar vortex goodbye?
Well, not really. The polar vortex is obviously always, for the most part, always there up in the poles. That's actually going to be a player in a warming trend we're going to have, because the polar vortex now is up near the pole, but it's going to slide westward toward Alaska around February 20th and warm us up quite a bit, 35 to 45 degrees for high temperatures for a few days in a row. But after that, it may swing down toward us, not coming down as much as it did earlier in the season, but it's still kind of a player that may swing south and bring us more bitterly cold air.
Mark Torregrossa, meteorologist for MLive and for FarmerWeather.com. Always good to talk with you. Thank you so much, and I guess keep that snowblower handy.
Yeah, bundle up.
Getting college students out of their classrooms, out of the academic bubble, and into communities, giving eager students an opportunity to take what they're learning and put it into practice in the real world, and at the same time, hopefully help the community. Certainly seems like a win-win for all sides. That's why students from Wayne State University and the University of Michigan are permeating the city of Detroit through many programs. We wanted to see what's been learned by all sides in these partnerships. We're joined by Jerry Herron, who's founding dean of the Honors College at Wayne State University. Welcome to the program, Jerry.
Thank you, Cindy. Good to be here.
And Larry Gant joins us. He's a professor at the University of Michigan, another university with very deep ties with the city of Detroit. Larry, good to have you with us.
Good day to both of you.
Jerry, I'll start with you. It's very clear that with Wayne's location right in the heart of Detroit, that the relationship between the students at Wayne and the people of Detroit are a given. It's really one of your selling points. Give us an idea of the kinds of programs that are sending Wayne students into the city.
Well, here at the Irvin D. Reed Honors College, I make to our incoming freshmen the following proposition, that Detroit is the most American place on planet Earth, that everything that makes us who we are is going further, faster here than anywhere else. So it's a heroic place, a place of extraordinary achievements. Also, it's the place where all the work we have left to do, if we're going to live up to the magisterial words of the Declaration about life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness, all that unfinished work lies immediately to hand here. So for a young person, this is the place to be, I think, if you want to engage the heroic past of our republic and also engage the tasks that lie before us. So our students take a year-long course on the city and city-making, on citizenship in the Honors College at Wayne State University, and part of that course is to take things that students learn in class and to move those directly into the community, to become meaningful members of this community, to become active agents in addressing some of these problems. And I make to them this following proposition about the Hamlet conundrum. Poor old Hamlet comes home for spring vacation. He's greeted by his father's ghost. His father's ghost charges him with these imponderable kinds of duties that lie upon that young man's shoulders, and he stumbles around five acts and never quite figures out what to do, falls on poisoned sword, and dies. So what you want not to do is to be defeated by the Hamlet conundrum, to figure out a problem that a group of undergraduate students can meaningfully do to take their learning and do something meaningful in the community to leave behind something of value there. And I think everybody wins in that case.
And Larry, what do you find that your students can gain from working in Detroit and bringing their budding skills to Detroit that they might not get, say, from, let's say, working in Ann Arbor or Ypsilanti?
I think that, one major point that very few of our students realize is that University of Michigan was founded in Detroit, not too far from where Wayne State's located, back around 1817. And so even though the university moved to the west, there are still these real deep roots. So I think the one thing that we try to make very, very clear is that there is a connection, a very, very clear connection with the University of Michigan and Detroit, and really that the fortunes are tied between the university and the city of Detroit. The second thing that we try to do is to say, you know what, it's really important to understand the whole city. Detroit is Americana, and as a matter of fact, I'll kind of extend a little bit on Jerry's points and say that, in my work, which takes me, around the world, Detroit is often seen as this very interesting, kind of harbinger of industrial city,
mm-hmm.
but also this kind of this new wave of a post-industrial neo-structural community that's rising again from the ashes. And I think one of the large questions that folks from around the world say is, how is it that the city is beginning to rise from the ashes, and what is it going to become? Our students don't quite get that, but they want to get that. And so we talk an awful lot about, listen, the city of Detroit is very interesting, but it's a host city, and you have to understand. So we take the impression that looking at Detroit, consider the same kind of preparations that you would make if you were going to go visit and you were going to go to hosting, okay? So you would understand something about the behaviors, something about the expectations, something about what you could and could not do. You wouldn't make a whole lot of assumptions about, you know, what is appropriate behavior and what is not. You wouldn't judge terribly. You wouldn't judge harshly. You would have an impression of curiosity. You would ask questions. But most of all, you would do it with an air of respect. And I think for a number of students, that kind of important, the importance of respect, the importance of being invited in to communities is what we really try to communicate. So it's not a coming down to the city of Detroit. It's working alongside the city of Detroit with a sense of respect and of wonder and of history as well, too. So we're not sugarcoating what has happened, but we're also not burying the city under lots and lots of challenges as well, too.
So we're talking about not a project, but a real partnership.
Absolutely.
Yes, exactly.
Absolutely.
And I think back to my Hamlet conundrum, you know, poor old Hamlet stumbles into that terrible plot, finally gets crushed by it because of the dimension of problems that he finds it impossible to conceive a solution.
Mm-hmm.
I think that if a student or anybody, a resident of greater metropolitan Detroit, and I would include all of us, however you want to count it, 3 or 4 million of us who live around this great city, not just the people inside 8 Mile Road, if you look at us today and you think, good grief, Detroit has these problems that confront the rest of urban America. I don't know, what am I going to do by 5 o'clock today, close a business about child illiteracy, urban poverty,
mm-hmm.
the way we treat old people in cities, et cetera, et cetera. Well, I don't know. I don't know how to solve that. So if I can't figure out a solution, you know, Hamlet-like, by 5 o'clock, I guess I don't have to do anything. Well, I think the point is to understand how we got here in this great city of ours. Where did we come from? What exactly were the steps that brought us to where we are today? And then you begin to understand that, oh, this is something that humans did. Good decisions, bad decisions, mm-hmm. heroic achievements, some achievements we ought not to be particularly proud of, but it's a human-made thing. And if it's a human-made thing, it's also a human-correctable thing. And that's the crucial point, I think, that see where we got, how we got to where we are, what decisions were made, and then to begin to think critically and meaningfully, creatively, about decisions that we might make as a result. And then I think the city ceases to be such a crushing problem. Child poverty, how am I going to solve
okay.
that by 5 o'clock this afternoon?
Sure.
Well, if there's something that a small group of people, young people especially, 4 or 5, can do to begin to understand urban agriculture, can begin to understand food security, can begin to understand how people can feed themselves on limited amounts of budget, and begin to become teachers, let's say, to help other people understand those kinds of problems, then I think that cosmic problem begins to be entirely approachable on an individual or a small group basis.
Larry Gant, would it be fair to liken the city to kind of a test lab? Is that at all fair?
The city's already involved in lots and lots of natural experiments. Now, they wouldn't call them that, but Jerry makes so many excellent points. Okay, this didn't happen overnight. It's at least a 60-year process of human attempts to solve problems in very human ways, some positive, not so positive. But he's also very, very correct in that what's happening now, and this is where, you know, I find very good solace, is that neighborhoods and people in neighborhoods have not turned the lights out on the city. And they're saying, okay, well, we've got this emergency management going on. We've got people kind of telling us what to do. Our neighborhood is not on the books for any kind of gentrifying urban development, okay? But what can we do?
Mm-hmm.
And so in many of the neighborhoods, you'll see residents kind of rolling up their sleeves, doing what they can do, you know, in their neighborhood to address core problems of illiteracy, of lights on, lights out, of, you know, providing safety and security to seniors. I mean, all of these wonderful stories that don't lead with blood. So, if it bleeds, it leads. Well, there's a lot of things going on in many neighborhoods. It doesn't sugarcoat the reality, but there's a lot of it going on in the neighborhoods that never gets covered by the news.
Sure.
And we provide our students that kind of opportunity to say, you know what, let's go in and let's learn alongside and let's work with these residents, these small community organizations, these small programs, both governmental and non-governmental, and let's see what's already going on. And is there something small that we can add that might help the program along, help the process along? Can we provide some resources? Can we provide listening? What can the students do?
So a very granular, really, really not macro at all, but really in there.
Right. I think crucially important to keep in mind that Detroit problems are American problems. And as Americans came relatively late to cities, we didn't stay long in cities as a dominant destination for us. By the 1970s, we were the first suburban population that had ever lived on our planet. So the things that happen when people come to a city, live in the city, benefit from the city, and then relatively soon leave the city behind, that's an American story. It's a story that is pronounced, perhaps, in particular detail in Detroit, but I think in confronting both the achievements and also the difficulties and the challenges of the city, it's important for our students to keep in mind that these are American things that we're looking at. They're not just things that exist inside of 8 Mile Road. And also, that just like our republic, Detroit has always been an experiment. Ever since, well, it's certainly an experiment in terms of inventing the modern world, the assembly line, and standardized production. No one ever thought of doing that before. No one imagined that people could come from all over the world, all over this country, to invent the mechanical modern world that we did here in Detroit. So in that sense, I think to join the experiment and say, yes, this is an experiment in progress, and we're still able to take a meaningful, active hand in this experiment, that's the excitement of the place.
What do you each feel have been the biggest successes of your school's partnership with the city of Detroit? I'll start with you, Jerry.
Well, I believe, in general, the engagement of a group of students, and typically our students work on a project in a small group, to engage a place that they've come to understand through some work that they do in class, and to find that, yes, I can understand and I can play a meaningful, I can become a citizen of this place in a real and practical sense. I think many of our students have grown up inside the mythology of Detroit. They've heard about the place their whole lives. Often, most recently, they've heard negative things about the place. And I think to discover that this is not some kind of stereotype, it's not some kind of image, it's not some kind of show that's being put on in the afternoon evening news. It's a real place where real people live that you can engage directly and learn from them as much as the place might benefit from your interaction. I think that's the dialogue, that might be the right word to call it, that one can open with the great city of Detroit. And I think that's illuminating and animating for everyone, and especially illuminating and animating for our students who find themselves being drawn to this place because of the experiences common to us all as Americans, drawn to it, learning from it, and then being able to be part of it, to become a citizen of this greater project of America, which is specially represented here in Detroit.
And as you see University of Michigan students, Larry Gant, making their way into volunteer in Detroit, what has been the most satisfying part of that for you?
I think, honestly, the increasing degrees and the increasing amount of respect and humility that our students bring with them when they seek opportunities and when they seek permission to engage with community partners and residents in the city. So there's been far, far, far less the notion of coming in as angels to save the residents or to save the neighborhoods or to save the community. Communities don't want that. Partnerships, yes. They don't want to be saved or rescued by this angelic third party. And it's nice to see the students realize that. So when they come in, they say, before we come in, what do we need to know? You know, how do we engage respectfully? And what are the boundaries? We can't give away everything. We've got, you know, we need to gain something, some learning and some resources and some information for ourselves, but how do we engage in partnership? And I also think that it also stretches the resident and community ability to learn and understand how complicated and how very, very different university partners are. University of Michigan and Wayne State, yes, we're both universities, but very different kinds of universities with very different kinds of resources, and one size doesn't fit all. So there's also some really interesting learning that residents and communities get to do about understanding the very different cultures of university partnerships.
Real interesting conversation. I thank both of you so much, Jerry Herron from Wayne State University and Larry Gant from the University of Michigan. Thanks for talking with us on Stateside.
Thanks, Cindy. Thanks, Larry. Good talking to you both.
Take good care, man. Okay.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. We have been exploring the effects of NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, on the show. NAFTA is 20 years old this year and has had dramatic effects on the state and America's economy. Today, what has NAFTA meant to the auto industry, in particular the movement of companies and jobs to Mexico, companies and jobs that used to be based in Michigan? We turn now to Stateside's partners with the BBC. Luis Fajardo, BBC correspondent. Good to have you with us, Luis.
Likewise.
So we look back at NAFTA, and it's impossible to ignore the fact that thousands and thousands of new jobs have gone to Mexico, factories set up by automakers and then the tier one suppliers. What has this meant first for the Mexican economy?
Well, it has been a very big deal for the Mexican economy. It is actually shown as one of the big success stories of NAFTA, which was, of course, a very controversial subject as well in Mexico. The fact is that they now can say, according to recent reports, there are more auto jobs in Mexico than in the U.S. Midwest. They estimate that nearly 40% of the jobs in North America now are in Mexico, actually. And they are saying now that they are the second car exporter to the U.S. They export actually more cars than Japan.
And looking at the workers, we see year to year there are economic increases for the Mexican workers, although we know they still don't match what their counterparts north of the border might be earning. But is there the expectation that wages for Mexican workers will increase, or do we think they'll pretty much stay where they are?
My understanding is that they are increasing. Of course, they make far, far less than in the U.S. They're equivalent in the U.S. But initially, the jobs that first began moving south of the border involved people making not enough money to sustain a middle-class lifestyle, which is what you are now starting to see. It is hard to say when, if ever, the Mexican salaries are going to reach U.S. levels. But definitely, it is seen as something that is improving.
And certainly, we see benefits that the Mexican workers are getting, profit sharing and vacation times and employee housing in some cases. Is that sustainable? Eventually, what would stop workers in Mexico from wanting basically parity with their counterparts north of the border? And then does that completely negate the whole point of the factories being in Mexico in the first place?
Well, for a long time, there was a worry in Mexico that when wage prices began to increase, Mexico was going to be excluded from the market because of competition from Asia. They were particularly worried that eventually jobs would move to China. But again, part of the happy story in this sense in NAFTA is that they're starting to see gains in productivity. So they believe that they are beginning to compete in productivity as well as just in simple wages.
If you just joined us, I'm speaking with Luis Fajardo, who's the BBC correspondent who covers Mexico and the auto industry. And we're talking about the impact of NAFTA and particularly the movement of companies and jobs to Mexico. And as you talk about this increase in the growth of the Mexican middle class because people have factory jobs to go to, does that also not mean that the agricultural sector in Mexico is shrinking? People are leaving farms and heading to the factories? And is this having an impact on Mexico's food supply and agricultural sector?
Yes, of course. It's good that you mentioned it because that's, I would say, the other side of the coin with NAFTA. While some sectors have benefited a lot from NAFTA, others have suffered substantially, and it has been, again, a matter of enormous controversy in Mexico. As was the case in the U.S., many people in Mexico saw NAFTA as a project impulsed by the elites and not necessarily taking into account what they understood were the interests of the common people. And, of course, a very substantial part of the Mexican population, compared to the U.S., is still involved in agriculture, and they have suffered, or parts of them have suffered quite a lot because of free trade coming from the U.S. They estimated that food imports are something like four times the amount they were in 1994. I read a report saying that corn imports had grown by nearly 15 times, and corn was the paradigmatic Mexican staple. And that has caused, obviously, a substantial amount of dislocation in agricultural areas. And also it has fueled movement to other sectors of the economy. So to make the point that NAFTA was, of course, enormously controversial in the U.S., but it was also very, very controversial in Mexico.
Luis, we see automakers from all corners of the world setting up in Mexico. Chrysler, Ford, GM, Nissan, Honda, Toyota, Volkswagen, plus heavy truck manufacturers. Is there any concern that the Mexican infrastructure cannot absorb all of this activity right now?
My understanding is that they have substantially improved their infrastructure during these last couple of decades. Of course, not to the levels of the U.S., but I think I do not see that as a fundamental problem for the continued expansion of the auto industry, or at least I don't think it is being presented as that at this moment.
Now, there is the issue of security concerns, and there are U.S. companies that have restrictions on their personnel visiting certain locations in Mexico. Some companies actually forbid their people from driving in Mexico, again, because of security concerns. Does this hamper job creation in Mexico?
I believe so. Yes, Mexican business interests are always saying the very, very substantial cost that security problems have on overall growth in Mexican industry, not only in the auto industry, but in general. My impression is that a lot of the problems now are concentrated in the northern part of the country. And in that sense, parts of the Mexican auto industry are moving in other directions.
Well, with knowing that Mexico exports 80% of its vehicles to the U.S., is there an expectation that that will continue or even increase? And what does that really mean to the U.S. labor force and actually workers here in Michigan who used to have jobs that have gone to Mexico?
I think most people accept that free trade agreements are going to have an impact. Some of it is going to be positive and some of it is going to be negative. There is substantial opposition right now to continue the free trade policies. Some left-wing groups in Mexico frequently say that there should be renegotiation of treaties and definitely not moving in that direction. I think that is going to be an ongoing controversy. Eventually, people accept that free trade agreements are going to have winners and losers, and very unfortunately for the U.S., a lot of the losers have been concentrated in the U.S. auto industry, and it is, of course, very striking that at the same time this is happening in Mexico, a middle class is appearing, a lot of it on the strength of a new auto industry that was taking, I guess, advantage of the situation that jobs were moving south of the border.
Luis, can you explain the opposition? Because from this side of the border, it seems like looking at what's happening, as you say, the growth of the middle class and jobs that have decent pay and benefits compared to, say, for example, working on the farm. What is fueling opposition to NAFTA in Mexico?
You have to remember that Mexico, throughout the 20th century, was a very, very nationalist country. They were also very afraid, I guess, of the impact U.S. economic domination, as they saw it, could have on their economy. So they would always try very strongly to protect their economy. When it finally happened at the end of the 20th century, it was seen as a very, very big step and a move away from the traditional economic strategy of Mexico, which was try to protect their internal economy and specifically to try to protect it from what they saw as a negative and threatening influence of the U.S. So I think the Mexican establishment had to do a very, very big political feat, I guess, in convincing and managing to create a new consensus around the possible benefits of this. And 2 decades later, they are seeing that effectively some of the groups in Mexican society have benefited a lot from free trade. But on the other hand, there is still a very strong nationalist current. You can see this, for example, recently in the discussion that happened last year around the energy sector. The energy sector was one of the last sectors in Mexico which was finally open to foreign investment, and this was in the last few months. And again, after a very, very big discussion over what were the possible threats of having a foreign presence and foreign control of their economy. So it has been a controversy throughout this whole period, and I would say it is likely to continue being so.
I've been speaking with Luis Fajardo, BBC correspondent. It's been a pleasure to talk with you, Luis. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
And now to the courtroom. If you were to come up with an adjective to describe just what happens in a typical courtroom, the word adversarial probably would pop into your mind. But there's a new but ancient dynamic happening in a Washtenaw County courtroom that's attracting great interest among the state's legal community. It's the new peacemaking court. For an explanation, we're joined by the Honorable Timothy Connors from the Washtenaw County Trial Court. Judge Connors, the peacemaking court is guided by Native American principles. Just what are those principles?
The real shout-out in many ways in our state deserves to go to Michael Petoskey. Judge Petoskey was a tribal judge that has been the architect of most of the tribal courts in the Lower Peninsula. And he went to the University of New Mexico Law School. And while he was there, he met several Navajo friends in law school with him, and he learned about the Navajo Peacemaking Court. those three principles that they use this affirmation, that the guiding principles are respect, relationships, responsibility. Hmm. And he was so struck by that when he came back, he just said in his own tribal communities in Michigan, said, I think this is values. Let's try it here. So several decades ago, he started the very first ones. So Judge Petoskey works closely with our Supreme Court, chair of our Tribal State Court Relations Committee, and he has been willing to come and help us build our first one in a state court system.
And why were you so open to saying, yes, I want to do this, and I want this happening in my courtroom?
Well, because I think it's exactly where we need to go. I've been on the bench for 23 years, and so I've seen, obviously, all the discord that comes forward. You know, there's a lot of divisiveness. And at the end of the day, rather than focusing on saying, all right, what went wrong? Who's been hurt? Why did it happen? Mm-hmm. When our tribal teachers have been telling us, the basic question we should always be asking is why, and then the why behind the why. Mm.
I'm speaking with the Honorable Timothy Connors from the Washtenaw County Trial Court, and in his courtroom is happening a peacemaking court guided by Native American principles. And this is really the first state court room in the nation offering this kind of procedure. So how do you decide whether a case might go to peacemaking court or take a traditional track, Judge?
Potentially any type of case in the state court system is eligible. But it does require the unanimous agreement of the parties to go into it. So it's a question of are their hearts in the right place? Are they really seeking peace? Or is it perhaps still a forum to act out? Not really seeking resolution, but simply trying to assert control over a situation.
So you could see juvenile probate, some civil and criminal disputes, any of that could wind up.
All of that, and we're working on that. We've handled several already. Obviously, it makes a great deal of sense in probate with guardianships and the distribution of property after the loved ones walked on, who's going to take care of people who are vulnerable. It has application. We've sort of used some of those principles even in disputes between small businesses because they have ongoing relationships. Obviously, it makes a lot of sense in domestic relations where a couple, even though they are divorced, they share these children that they brought into the world, and they are going to have those situations. My great hope, though, is for the juvenile court.
Yes.
One of the traditions, one of the great teachings that we learn from our tribal neighbors is the respect that is given to elders and to children, and children are sacred.
So thinking of those guiding principles, the Navajo principles of respect, relationships, and responsibility, can you give us a compare and contrast? Could you tell us, describe the type of case that you might have before you in peacemaking court? Give us a sense how it might be handled typically, and the difference if it's in peacemaking court.
Sure.
Give me a for
instance.
Sure.
Let's take a juvenile case.
Okay.
Let's take a young juvenile who broke into a house and took money out of somebody's purse and went off and blew the money. And the typical scenario would be, okay, you're caught, you came in, what did you do? The focus is on what the event is. All right, here's your punishment. You're the juvenile delinquent. Here's your fines and costs, and here's your punishment. And a judge like me sits up on a bench and yells at the young person and says, don't you ever do that again, and if you do, we'll really come down on you.
I don't want to see you in my courtroom one more time.
Right.
Or else.
Right.
Okay. How would this differ in a peacemaking court? What would happen?
So in a peacemaking court, it would start off with that proposition of, okay, what happened, but then what were you thinking to the young man? What were you thinking at the time? What do you think about it now? Who do you think it affected? You need to hear from them how it affected them. If it's truly the idea, I want to make amends, then what is that proposal? And then there's the similarity that if it's done and is true, remorse and you make it up, then there has to be forgiveness on the other side. I've sat on the bench in some of our tribal courts and in their juvenile court when there has been that successful application of peacemaking, those three aspects, and then return back. They actually burn the juvenile file in a ceremony with everybody and say, you are no longer this label. You are back on the path of a true human being. that would be too radical for our state court system, but certainly the concept that we're putting it back and there's forgiveness and we've created behavior that's acceptable.
There is going to be that sense, I think, that the public will have that a wrongdoer, like let's just say this typical young person we just talked about who stole money from a house, needs to pay society back in some way, which we equate as punishment. Do you think this can overcome that overall perception that we've basically as a society grown up with, that you gotta pay?
You know, I love this question. When we were listening to Judge Petoskey last week, the tribal judge, he had the same issues within his own tribal community. And those that said, oh, I don't know, this sounds like a lot of kumbaya, huggy-feely, you're coddling, you got to get tough on these kids, etc. So this is a common sort of fear, I would say. For those who are fearful of this idea, again, everybody has to agree. So ultimately, who, when we say this young person has to learn, who really is the one the most affected but the lady who had the money stolen from her purse in her own home? If that person finds peace and closure in a healthy way, should we not as a society say, that's a good thing. This young man has learned a lesson in the heart. He's changed his direction. He's made it right with the person that he hurt. And we, as a society, are better off. We have a system in place that if people don't care and are going to continue negative behavior, we have a system already in place to say, well, we need to deal with that and address it and punish it or protect it. But that doesn't mean that that's the model for every situation of human discord.
The Honorable Timothy Connors from the Washtenaw County Trial Court talking about the peacemaking project in Washtenaw County. Thank you so much, Judge.
Thank you.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Allie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Chris Haddle, Mercedes Mejia, Katie Suha, and Claire Tennisketter. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening, and let us talk tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock.